Is this Janie?
Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2115. That's 2115. On Wednesdays and Fridays, we have special guests that come on, and usually they show up. And I'm hoping that Janie Terry from Sacramento, California will be calling in, okay? She will be our special guest tonight. I have a 619 area code here. Who am I speaking to? Okay, we have 64734. Is this by any chance Lisa? Lisa, is that you?
It is I, and I think 619 is actually a San Diego area code, if I'm not mistaken. And good evening, Carol.
Yeah.
How the hell are you?
Oh, I'm just doing fine and dandy. I'm starting to talk funny now that I live here. I'm fine and dandy.
Oh, as long as you're dandy,
anyway,
then it's okay.
I guess so. Okay. Well, anyway, let me get on with this show. Everyone, this is the Stop Child Abuse Now show. I am Carol Levine. I am a vice president of NASCA. I'm also an author, and I am, above all and everything else, I am a survivor. Okay, that's what's important to me and to most people here. It's very, very important for people to understand that there is a place to heal and there is a way to heal. But before we get into that, and maybe this 619 area code might be the lady that we're hoping for. Oop, don't disappear on me, honey. Okay, let me try it again. 619 area code, who am I speaking to? We've got 2 619s. Okay, let me open the 619. 619 area code, here we go. All right, Janie, this is you. I can see this is you.
Yeah.
Are you there?
I'm so glad I got through. How you doing?
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you called in. Before I get started with the show, okay, they really like it when I read the NASCA mission, so I'm going to do that. And then we'll get to your story. You have quite a story here, and you also are a hypnotherapist. My deceased husband, he died a little over a year and a half ago. He too was a board certified hypnotherapist, and I believed in all that stuff until he hypnotized me. I lost 20 minutes. So guess what? I'm a believer. Okay. Let me give. Yeah, it does work. It does help a lot of people. Okay, it's just one way, one thing that can be used for trauma and so forth. Let me get on with the NASCA mission here, so I don't get yelled at by the boss. Not really. Okay, I'm teasing. All right, NASCA mission. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two specific perspectives, and that is, number one, educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, which it is. We know this. This is worldwide. and that it does affect everyone. Yeah. And number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. It's very important to know that when you have been horribly abused, you know, first of all, people so often they hide that abuse for many, many years, and then they decide that they're miserable enough, I guess, that they need help. And I just want you to know that there is hope, okay? I don't care what you've gone through in your lifetime, but there is definitely hope for the, people, for survivors. So tonight we have as a special guest Janie Terry, and she is from Sacramento, California. She's a survivor and a clinical hypnotherapist. And I don't like I don't like reading just from the bio, because I want you to tell your story as it's written here. Which is the information you supply for Bill. But I will at times, you know, prompt you or help you. And what I do, see, we have a panel here now of people, which is good. We have Lisa from New York. Hello, Lisa. Lisa, we already said hello. We have Deborah from Arizona.
Hi.
I'm Glenn. And I'm glad she's here. And we have Joe from Oregon. And then we have our special guests, and there'll probably be more. And then, of course, you have myself. Oh, boy, oh, boy. So anyway... what I want to do here is tell your story, you know, chronologically. That means so people can understand, like, I'm just going to give you a little pep talk here. Like when you first started to realize that you were being abused, okay, how old you were, if you remember, and the type of family you came from, the things like that, so people can understand better, more about you, okay?
Okay.
So tell us how old you were and so forth. Go ahead.
I'm 37, and my story is, it really begins right from the start, from the very beginning of my life. I was born to two very young and very, very troubled kids. You know, they were 17 and 18. They were straight out of high school. They were high school sweethearts. And they had both had tumultuous upbringings. Both of them had had physical and sexual abuse themselves. So they ran away, got married, and immediately were pregnant with me. And that right away was just a recipe for disaster. So we were, I think, on the street a lot in the very beginning, all of us. At times when we were able to have a roof over our head, there really wasn't any food. And I was just a three-month-old baby when my mother became pregnant again. So everything was happening very fast for them, and babies were coming, and there was no food, no money. My biological father began using drugs very quickly, and everything just went downhill. And one day, they split, and they split for good. And my mother took my little brother and I, we were only a year apart to the day, took us to some friends, and she said, "Can my children stay here with you?" You know, we were two and three at the time. And she said, "You know, I'm on the street with them. Is there any way that you can have my babies stay here? And I'm going to come check on them, and I'm going to bring whatever I can to help with them, but I can't keep them on the street with me." What that really meant is that she was already prostituting. She was already having to use her body in order to, you know, just have any means of getting by on the day-to-day. And so we went and we stayed with her friend, and her friend had young sons, but they were much older than the two of us, my brother and I. They were all in their teenage years. And one of those boys, a 16-year-old boy, who had already had a lot of problems, he was a very problematic child already. He had already been through the juvenile hall system. He was already having a lot of issues. He came up to my room. I was staying in a room that felt very much like an attic. It was off of the kitchen. You'd have to go up these steep stairs, and you went into this room with this peaked roof, and it was just big enough really for a bed, you know, and there was one window, and I would sleep up there with my brother. And this boy, this 16-year-old boy, came up the stairs one afternoon during my nap time. And I remember him crawling into bed with me. And I can remember it like it happened yesterday. I remember everything. I remember the way he looked and the way and the things that he said to me, even though I was just over 3 years old at the time, just over three, about three and a half. And he crawled into bed, and he started reading me a familiar book. And then he asked me if he could touch me, and he asked me if I could touch him. And before I knew it, all of my clothes were off, and I can remember him lying flat on his back. And I can actually remember, I still see it through my little JJ eyes. JJ is what they called me when I was that young. So I can still see it through her eyes. I still see this youthfulness, even though he was older than me, this very soft 16-year-old skin. I mean, he was just a boy, you know, himself. And he grabbed my little body, and with him flat on his back, he sat me down on top of him like you're sitting a heavy vase full of flowers on your coffee table. And he just plopped me really fast and hard down over his, you know, over his erectile penis. I mean, he actually penetrated me all the way. And I can remember the pain of it. I remember feeling stuck, literally, emotionally, everything stuck. He was stuck. And that's the thing that sticks with me. I think he felt like even in that moment, there was no going back. There was no going back to the boy he was before he did what he did in that moment. And there was no going back for me. I could never be as innocent as I was the moment before this all happened. And we were stuck, literally, figuratively stuck. And I think because I screamed, I stirred somebody from below, from down in the kitchen, because we were not alone in the house. And right. I can remember him trying to jerk me off of him, pull my body off of him, which was very difficult to do because I was so tiny. And finally broke free of his body, there was blood everywhere. It was a mess. And I remember there being a very big comforter. And so he pulled the comforters over us. And he kept saying, get your underwear on, get your underwear on, get your nightie, get your nightie. But I couldn't find anything. Everything was buried in that bed somewhere, you know, with now this secret. It was just, everything was in the bed and tangled and a mess and scary. And so he gave me his shirt. And I remember that, putting his shirt on and it being so big on me because I'm wearing this boy shirt. I'm a little tiny toddler. And I still could not find my underwear. And so he's lying next to me, and I still remember him putting his hands casually. Like it was very intentional body language. He put his hands behind his head as if to look relaxed. He wanted to look very relaxed because he knew someone was about to pop through that door any second. We could hear the footsteps coming up. And it was a woman. And she came to the foot of the bed. And I don't remember if I knew her or not. I just know that my memory is that it was a woman. And she stood at the end of the bed. And she's looking down at us. And I just felt like I was lying in this bed of shame. I knew that even at that age, and I find that so interesting, that even at three and a half, I knew we had done something bad, and I knew that it was something I should be embarrassed about, even though I had nothing to do with the choice or didn't even know what I was doing, that immediately I took that on me. Like, I did something very bad. And I'm very, very embarrassed right now, very ashamed. And this woman didn't ask a lot of questions. I do remember that. I remember wondering why she didn't know more. And again, it's that constant reminder that children know so much more than adults give them credit for. If we all went back to our little brain, right? Are you ever so curious? How did I know so much so young, you know?
Yeah.
And we do learn so much, and I processed it in a very mature way for as young as I was. I really knew that something very bad had happened to me, that this woman should have asked questions, pushed back the covers, you know, what not. But instead, she kind of said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm just reading her bedtime story. You know, I'm helping her to take a nap. There was silence. And then she turned around, spun on her heels, and walked out. But she told him to come on downstairs. And that was it. That gave him time when she left the room to gather himself, to clean up, and to leave. And
right.
I stayed
Let's
in
stop
bed.
There. Okay.
Please.
Let's stop there. Okay. You've already given us a wealth of, you know, information here. And I'm so sorry you had to go through that. That's horrifying. We all, you know, there's so many of us that have gone through such terrible situations just as yours. And it's good that we're on this show because we're educating those people out there that just don't get it, that even children as young as a 2 and a half, say, a little toddler, you know, can be penetrated and all this. Well, now what I want to do is I want to go to the panel because we have a panel here and I haven't given them the chance yet, you know, to say hello and to welcome you to the show. And so Lisa from New York, you're the first one that called in. Go ahead and say hello.
Well, I already said hello, and this story went downhill fast. It's disgusting. I'm horrified that to anybody that it happened to you. I think I'm going to invent new words at the end with us tonight. I don't want to say I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the story, but I'm very curious. And thank you for being on the show and telling this horrific story in such a gracious, formal way. I am humbled by you.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Yeah.
I appreciate everything you've just said.
You know, see, people many times they get blown away, you know, or then there are those people that get triggered because maybe they were, say, 2 and a half, 3 and a half years old when they were abused. And it's very hard. But, you know, we have to educate people so that they can understand, you know, what to do with this, okay, and that there is hope and there is help. That's the good news. Let me bring on Deborah from Arizona, and then I'll bring Joe on, who actually called in really, really first. Deborah, go ahead.
What you've already said is so important, and how you can illustrate that in my mind is beautiful and horrible all at the same time. You speak with eloquence, and I appreciate that. And I really look forward to hearing the rest of your story. But I think it's very important that you say it out loud, because if you don't say it, nobody's going to hear it. So, but I greatly appreciate you being here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you so much.
Okay. Let me bring on Joe from Oregon. Joe, is there something you'd like to say or make a comment about? I'm sure. Go ahead.
Hi, Janie. For you to remember that in such detail must be I guess I'm like the others, just really blown away with it, and like you were saying, that even at that age you felt some like you had done something wrong, even though it wasn't your fault. So, that's just amazing. But I appreciate you sharing that and being able to say it without, without totally breaking up or whatever. And so you're a very strong survivor, and I appreciate you coming here tonight.
Thank you, Joe. Absolutely. It's so nice to connect. Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
We all appreciate your being here. You know, it's not that we're trying to horrify, if you will, the public, but society. You know that as well as I do. But they have to understand that when children are put in terrible positions, that these things happen. And it's just not just one or two here or there, you know. It happens so often, so often. and how it can destroy, you know, a person's life, a little child's life. And this is why we fight so hard at NASCA, you know, to try to educate the public. So I thank you as well for being here. My abuse started at the age of six. I'm sorry. six. And I was kidnapped in New York when I was eight. I mean, you've got me a little blown away, too, because it's so tiny. You know, you were so tiny. And, you know, all these things happened to you. And, you know, let me tell you something. As far as memory is concerned, many of us remember things like certainly from when we were four. I know I do. You know?
Yeah.
So, at an earlier age, you know.
Yeah.
That's I find that outstanding. All right, so let's get on with your story here, because you have a ways to go, and it's quite a story. And so, all right, you've been put in harm's way, if you will, in this house, this so-called friend's house, and the son had sexually abused you and actually, I'm sure, injured you. What happened next? Right. You're under the covers. And and he says he's reading the book. The lady, whomever she is, you don't seem to know who she was. Maybe she's a friend of a friend. Who knows? But the point is, you're lying there as a very, very young child, injured.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next?
Sometime later, the mother that owned this house, and this was her son, she came up. She was apparently actually at work, so I found out much later that it was not her who came into the room to check on me. There was someone else in the house, a girlfriend, I believe, of one of the elder sons who had come up. So the mother had come home from work, unaware what her son was doing in the house with me, came up to check on me, and I was bleeding so profusely. They thought I was hemorrhaging. I mean, they didn't know what had happened. She pulled back the covers, and there was so much blood that I was rushed to the hospital. Well, it didn't take them long to figure out that I had been sexually molested, abused. And I ended up spending almost a month in the hospital. I contracted gonorrhea at that young age. So this part is hard. I'm not able to have children because of what happened. So I was not able. I'm not able to carry. And so I was there for almost a month, about 3.5 weeks in the hospital. And my biological mother, of course, found out that night what had happened. She came to check on us. She was very happy because she had finally gotten a job at the Payless shoe store, and she was going to manage. Mm-hmm. And she was so thrilled because she was finally getting her act together. She was going to have money, and she was going to get a place for us, and everything was going to be okay in her eyes. And it seems to be the theme of her life. As soon as something happens, it's like, the shoe drops very quickly for her. It always has. So she came to the house. This is way before cell phones, as you all know. And so she had no idea. No one had contacted her. She came to the house just to tuck us in, not knowing I was in the hospital, not knowing what had happened. And Neil, my brother, Neil, he's my biological brother, a year younger than me, he had already been removed from the house and was already placed in another foster home that very night. So my mother, her name is Tawny, she came to the house and knowing that Neil now has been placed somewhere, that we are no longer in her, that she had lost her parental rights, like right then and there, you know what I mean? And we were now wards of the state, like immediately. And so, she had a total breakdown because she had gone her whole life. My mother had been raped by her stepfather from the time she was 8 years old to the time she left and ran off and married my father at 18. So she vowed that she would never let something like that happen to her own babies. And for that to happen to her, it felt like, is this our curse? Is this, you know, can we never break it? Because it just happens in our family line. And the women are very abused. They're suicidal. Many of them have been successful at, you know, taking their own lives. And so it was her hope to break that cycle, and for it to happen to me, and happen to me so young, broke her spirit. So we're in the same hospital together. I'm on one floor being treated for gonorrhea and tears to my vagina and all of the trauma that had happened to me. And she's on the psychiatric floor. She's highly sedated. She's on the psychiatric floor. One psychiatric nurse at one point did sneak her up to see me at one point, but she was not supposed to. She was supposed to not see us and not have contact with us. And so I was released, and I went to go meet my brother at the new home. And for some reason, this was in San Diego County, they placed us in a home that was Spanish-speaking, and we are not Spanish-speaking mm-hmm. children. And the house, they spoke very broken English, but it really, once you got into the house, it was no English. You do not speak English. If you speak it, you're punished for it. So he was just starting to learn to speak. He was very, very young. He already had speech impediment problems, you know, just with all the trauma and the uncertainty of our life. It was not easy for him to even learn how to speak correctly. I certainly was having a lot of trauma issues. And so we developed our own language with one another. I would generally speak for him. He would kind of talk to me in sort of this broken Spanglish, and I would translate for him. And I very quickly became his mother. I mean, by the time I was four, I spoke for him. I advocated for him. I made sure he was fed. I would stand in front of him and take any brunt of any abuse that we received. I mean, it was just whatever I could do to protect him, that was my role. And I learned that very, very quickly. The house that we were in for that next year and a half was worse than even that one night with that boy. And that's hard to imagine, but it really was. At least I could say that happened one time with the boy, or that the boy was just a very, very troubled young child himself. Mm-hmm. The second place that we went to, they were in their 50s. It was prolonged. It was sadistic. It was evil. They would have us kneel down on boards of nails in front while they watched television. They'd have us lying, like kneeling in front of them on these nails to bring terror and scare us and control us. And they would tie our hands behind our back and make us put our chin on the wall for hours until we stopped crying. And then we both have to be totally silent. So if Neil was crying, I still had to be on the wall. If I was crying, Neil had to be on the wall. And so we learned how to be very symbiotic in the way that we thought. And I mean, we started having the same dreams, he and I, my brother and I. We almost became twin souls at that time, because we had to work together in order to survive. Mm-hmm. And when they realized how close our bond was, they decided to separate us. And that was one of the worst punishments, was that I couldn't see my brother, my only one person who I knew loved me and that I knew loved, you know, we loved each other.
And, of course.
Mm-hmm. So he would be banished to one room and I was banished to another. And the sexual abuse was constant and happened from both of them. I would wake up in the bed between the two of them. We'd all be naked. I have a memory of us running errands. This was common when we'd go to run errands at the store. He would always park the car way back, as far back as he possibly could, and send her in to go run the errands, to go grocery shopping. And mm-hmm. so he parked car way in the back, and I can remember it being myself, my brother, and another little foster child, a boy, and we were in one of those older models, so the car, it was just a bench seat in the front and a bench seat in the back. And so I say that, there's a specific reason I say that, because my memory is that I'd be sitting in the back seat And he would say to me in Spanish, come up here, get up here, come up here right now. And I would say, no. And all he had to do was ask me twice. And by the third time, he would take the back of my hair, and I'm four and a half at this point, take the back of my hair and drag my whole body over that bench seat to the front seat with him, expose himself and expect me and make me give him oral copulation. And so these things were happening constantly and happened for a year and a half. And what I was most horrified at is that I also have memories of social services people being in the house. I can see them with their suits on. I can see them sitting with their legs crossed on the couch and taking notes. And I do recall one time, I'm on the wall, as I called it. So they didn't tie my hands that time because I think they knew they were being watched, but my hands had to be held behind my back and my chin on the wall. And I remember social services being there and taking notes of this, which I found even then shocking and just heartbreaking. And, you know, it makes you lose hope that anyone's going to help, that anyone's going to step in and do something. And so I was wearing coats all the time. I mean, I'm in San Diego, and that's unusual to be in sweaters and tank, you know, turtlenecks and this, but I am. I'm in these things all the time. And at this point, I'm sent to kindergarten. And as much as I would like to say that going to kindergarten was my safe haven, it wasn't. There was a little boy at the school that was abusing me and hitting me on the playground, and I was terrified to go out. And so one day, I can remember sitting on the carpet in that kindergarten classroom, and I remember it being this bright, fantastic blue, and I remember the railroad tracks painted into this carpet, and I'm sitting on it, and it's reading time, and there's children around me, and there's two women in the room, probably these two kindergarten teachers. And suddenly, there's a bell that rings for recess, and that was it. That was the first time I can remember having a full-on panic attack. That recess bell was this bell that said, you're going to go out, and that little boy's going to find you, and he's going to hurt you again. And every fear, everything I felt, all came flooding to the surface. And it was as if the room just started, like my vision just closed in. You know, like when, like those old cartoons when they would end at the very end and everything would come down to a tiny little pin drop and then go to black. That's what it looked like to me. And I couldn't catch my breath. And I can remember these men and calling my name over and over, you know, Janie. And I could hear them less and less. The more they did it, the further they sounded. And that, I believe, is the start of when people really started to take notice and really started to ask the questions. And that was a year and a half into this nightmare. I don't know why it took that long. I can't imagine what took that long, you know, but it did.
Let me ask you something. I was very young. I was six when the sexual abuse started. And, of course, that's a lot older than you. That was terrible. Yeah, but six is certainly too young, too. And my question to you is, I remember always being sore, so terribly sore. I mean, you were in the hospital. You had all these things happen to you in the hospital where they had to repair your vagina. And unfortunately, you can't have children today and all this other stuff. I'm so sorry for that. I have friends, too, that have similar stories to yours as well. And did you keep getting infections, you know, like urinary tract infections?
Constantly.
Did you ever have those?
I can't have intercourse of any kind. It can't happen for anything. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's penis or a toy or fingers, I can't have anything penetrate me at all. It just can't happen. If it does, I have an infection immediately. So it changed everything about my life. I mean, everything. Yeah.
Well, when you were a child, you must have had infections too. I'm trying to think on a clinical level, because you're going to school, and you said people are starting to take notice. And, yes, people like Dyfus and things like that, they certainly weren't trained at all during that time period. I mean, maybe a little tiny bit of training. And then there were those that just didn't care, okay, that's as much as they should have. So things would slip by, and I can understand how you felt like even these people won't help me, or, you know, they won't help me. You must have felt terribly lost and then terribly sad. And just, you know, when you're at that age, God bless children at that age who are being abused, because it may break our spirit, absolutely. But on the other hand, we still have a toughness about us. And you had a toughness about you. I can tell this by you. I can tell by your actions. So that's what helped also, too, for you to continue to live. You mentioned that it's a generational thing in your mother's family, where there's people with this suicide and all these other things. And many times it is generational. And that doesn't make it any better, you know. I'm hoping, I'm going to hope that, of course, that you did and you were the one that broke the cycle. So I want to go back to the panel, because I know there's probably questions that they want to ask you. And I'm very thankful at this point that someone started to realize that, hey, something's not quite right here, okay? So let me go to Lisa in New York and see if she has a comment or a question.
Sure. Well.
Lisa?
You know, Carol, you said, yeah. Hello? Can you hear me?
Hi, Lisa.
Oh, yeah, we hear you.
Oh, okay, there you are. Okay. And, Carol, you just said, well, back in those days, DYFS didn't know what they were doing. They still don't. I think they're worse today because they don't care, like you said. There's no accountability. I'm getting really pissed off. I'm getting really pissed off listening to this story. You know, pissed off in a good way. And, you know, Carol and I had a couple of conversations, and I want to say this. You're telling this story in an extremely graphic way. You're not censoring yourself. You're not filtering yourself. And that's what the public needs to hear. This is not a story that needs to be sanitized. This is not people need to hear you say these words and hear what you're saying and talk about rape and talk about the blood and talk about these things. And this is not a subject that should be sanitized or have the rough edges sanded down. And I really commend you, because it seems to me like you don't give a crap what you say or what people think about you for saying it. And you go, girl, you are fantastic. You are amazing.
Yeah. I agree with you.
Absolutely.
Lisa gave me that word sanitized, and I've used it. How often do we say, you know, let's not sugarcoat things, you know? But sanitized,
exactly.
That's a really good word. I like that, yes. Thank you for that, Lisa.
Yeah,
okay, let's go to it's so fitting, isn't it? Okay, let's go to Deborah here in Arizona and see if she has a question or a comment to make.
No, absolutely. Number one, I agree with what Lisa and Carol are saying about the sanitation of your comments. I love that you're being upfront and being real. This is real. And that's what the listeners need to hear, is being real is the most important part of getting that appreciation out there for what really happened in your life. And by appreciation, I don't mean, oh, they should appreciate it, but the appreciation that you are able to speak about it and able to put it out there. I love that, and I just personally had a few things happen in my life that makes me want to go, okay, I'm going to unsanitize my life.
There you go.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm going to do, and that's what's going to happen. And you putting this out there and how you're speaking about your story, I feel for it, and I want to hear more about it, and I so greatly appreciate what you were saying tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deborah.
You
bet. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Joe in Oregon. Go ahead, Joe. Do you have a comment or a question that you'd like to ask?
Yeah. Janie, have you talked about this with anyone before? Because you sound so calm now and that you're able to talk about it. And I was wondering if you've had anyone that you've been able to share it with before to reach that state.
Joe, that's a great question. And yes, but my story, as I tell it a little further, you'll see that that wasn't always the case, and I'd like to explain what happened because I kept it down for so long. But yes, I did eventually learn how to talk about it. Yes.
I can understand why you didn't talk about it as a child, because you've had so many opportunities to get help from the DHS folks visiting and from teachers and things until you actually had to break down. So
that's right.
But
yeah,
thank you for sharing that. Thank you.
Oh, gosh. Thank you. That's a great question. And I will get further into the answer of that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I thank you, panel, for all those good questions and comments. Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm not too happy with the system either, you know. So, you know, they have a long ways to go before they can walk tall, let's put it that way, and we know what that means. Okay, so why don't you continue on, you know, with your story, and so far, you're out in the playground, and all this stuff happened to you. And school is not the safe haven that you thought it was going to be. Tell us a little more about that and what you did exactly, what happened to you. What did they do with you? Go ahead.
If I were writing a book, that would be the end of one chapter, and the next would be that I was removed from that home. I have... And over the years, been able to locate documents, transcripts of conversations that I imagine were social service personnel speaking to me. At that age, I would have been around 5, asking me about the way that I was treated in the house. And my heart breaks for JJ. I refer to her that way because that's who I'm speaking of, the little me. My heart breaks for her because I can see in black and white the specific verbiage of that little girl trying to still protect, you know, I actually referred to them as mom and dad. And in the transcripts, I would say, well, yes, he hit my face, but mommy put ice on it because she loves me. That kind of stuff. You know, I would say it like that.
Right.
I constantly was looking for, well, let me show you where the love is. You know what I mean? Because children, that's what we're looking for. I mean, we as human beings, that's what we're always looking for. That's why people stay in abusive relationships for a long time. You know, it's like the love is here somewhere because that is our ultimate language. So we're always looking for it. And even at that age, I'm trying to find where I was loved, you know, where I was worthy of that, even if it meant that I was given ice because they hit me. And I was removed from that home with my brother. And at this point, San Diego did one thing right. They did determine that my brother and I could not, absolutely, without a doubt, we would never be separated. We could not be separated. That they felt at this point that we were so bonded emotionally, mentally, psychologically, that they literally thought we may not survive without one another, that it was in peril that we stay together. And so we did. And we went to this third house. The woman, she was Sue McClellan, that was her name. She was a single mother, and she had 2 biological teenage daughters, 17 and 18-year-old girls. And she thought she'd try fostering. And so we were her first fosters, and she was a sweet, sweet lady. She was around in her 50s at the time, and she quickly bonded with us. She thought about adopting, but I think she thought at that time she was maybe a little too old to to actually raise little kids all the way up, you know, through their childhood. So she thought it would be very temporary for her, and she would just foster us for a few months, and that would be it. She ended up fostering over 300 children and received an award many years later, sometime when I was in my 20s, for her service as a foster care person in San Diego. But we were her first, and we gave her a little bit of a run for her money, and not because we were bad kids. In fact, we were very, very well behaved. I mean, we were terrified to ever step out of line. However, because of the trauma, we, you know, we showed up in her house speaking mostly Spanish, for one thing. Neil really wouldn't speak to anyone but me. And because we had been so deprived of one another, my brother and I, it was almost impossible to separate us. And I believe, and again, this is just I'm assuming this. I believe that she was told to put us in separate bedrooms. I think that that was a request that we would be separated, but not to hurt us or harm us or punish us, but just to try to give us some level of independence, because we were so, so bonded. But what would happen is, every night, like clockwork, as soon as she put us down, as soon as the lights would go out, I would sneak over to my brother's room. I would pull his arm until he, my little sleepy eyes, he'd get up out of bed, and I would drag him over to my bed, and I'd put him under the covers with me. And like clockwork, it was as if she were waiting right at the end of the hall. She tiptoed back into her room, and we did this routine about 10 times each night before we'd all finally just give up, and I fell asleep. But she'd carry him back to his bed, and she would do that. She never punished us. She never called us out on it. She just silently would pick him up and carry him back. And I would stubbornly go get him again. I never fought her on it. There was never words exchanged. It was just this dance that we all did the whole time we were there. And that dance continued years. I mean, I did that with Neil until I was probably around 9 or 10 years old. So it went on a long time. And,
well, you can understand that, though. You can understand that. To try and survive when you're in situations like this, I didn't have any of that bonding. None of us, a lot of us don't, have bonding even with a brother or sister. And without one or the other, you guys probably wouldn't have survived. You know what I'm saying? You needed that. And that's why that first family you're with, oh, gross. See, they knew to separate you just to punish you. You know, that was so sad. So continue on. I'm really quite fascinated with your story, and you're doing a wonderful job. You truly are.
Oh, okay. No, thank you for that. We stayed in that house for about 6 months, and it was at that time that she started to talk to us about a forever family. Those were the words that she used, and she said you would have a forever family. And I remember still asking about my biological mom, mostly my mom. I don't really remember ever asking about my biological father. He had been in and out of jail and for small drug offenses, but enough that I just don't think I had a lot of remembrance of him. And Neil certainly didn't. But I did remember my mother, and I did ask about it. And she told us that we were loved and that our parents always loved us, and that they were very sick, and that they were getting well, and that, you know, we would have a forever family, and that our parents were going to help find them, and they would know who was right. And, you know, she would have that kind of conversation. And I can remember going to a courthouse, and I saw my biological mother for the first time in a long time. And she's a really soft-spoken, if you listen to her, she sounds like a kitty cat. You know, she just has this really soft, like almost, I don't know, almost like Jessica Rabbit, but not like saturatedly sexy, but just this really sweet, soft voice. And I can remember her sitting in this bench, you know, this courthouse bench right in front of us. Neil and I were right behind her. And she had Gumby, the little cartoon Gumbies, like a Gumby figurine and then his
little
Gumby.
Yeah, I remember Gumby.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they were you could mold them and move them around in your hands. You could make them mold and into different positions. And she pulled them out of her purse, and she's still this way. She's so childlike from her own abuse that her purse reminded me then, and it reminds me now, of the same kind of purse you would expect a six-year-old little girl to have. If she dumped it out on the floor, it would be crayons and paper and, you know, Gumbies, and, you know, it would just be really random stuff. And that's how her purse was then, you know, as a grown adult woman. She just had toys and crayons and things in there. So she pulls out these Gumbies. And she reached back, and she always called this baby. And she said, "Here, babies, here, babies." And she gave the Gumby, one to Neil, one to me. And they told her in that time that that was it, that we were, you know, she hadn't met the requirements. She was still in the street, still prostituting, and didn't do what she was supposed to do to get custody, so we were still going to be wards of the state. And I think she figured then that after all this time that it was just best, and she later tells it that they really were telling her at that time, if you really love your children, you'll sign them away, you'll let them go. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of keeping them in the foster system, you'll just let them go. Mm-hmm. And so she really had resigned herself at that point. And so we all were crying. She was crying. We were crying. And got so upset. And they were trying to pull us and take us away out of the room. And Neil dropped his Gumby and he couldn't find it. And we're freaking. Everybody's just having a big mess of a cry. And I think they all felt bad for us. Whoever was in the room said, okay, give them a few more minutes. Just let them out of the courtroom. They can sit out in the hallway for a few minutes and just let them be together for a few more minutes. This part makes me a little emotional, you guys, so excuse me. Because I remember it, and then I also got to talk to her about it years later, and we got to reminisce on it. But she goes out to the hallway, and she sits on a bench, and it was such a small bench that she could only fit Neil on her lap. And I sat on the floor, but my head and my arms were folded over her lap. And she's trying to bounce Neil to get him to stop crying because he's crying so hard. And he's so confused. And so she says, I don't know what to do. So she pulls out of her purse a pad of paper and some crayons. And she said, here, JJ, paint. Show Mama a picture. Draw Mommy a picture, you know, just to get me to calm down. Because she thought, if I calm down, Neil will. Because Neil did what I did. Neil mimicked me a lot. And so I remember drawing. And what she always said was, Mama just needs a house. If Mom can get a house, then we can all be together. So I drew a house. The windows and the door and everything, and I drew the paper, and I said, here's our house. So here, this is it. This is where we go, and this is where we can be. So she told me many years later that she kept that in her purse forever.
Yeah.
She was mugged. She was mugged sometime when I was in my teens. And
before you go any further, let me ask you how old you're. Yes. There was a little bit of noise there. How old were you at this point, and your brother? How old were you when this behavior was going on in the courtroom? How old were you?
Six. Just about six. I was just under 6 years old.
Six.
I mean, it would have been just under five. Yeah, I was just turning six. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you see, it shows that even at that age, remember, we do things chronologically here, and we're also trying to teach people. You had gone through all that horrible grief with that one family, and this foster lady that you were placed with seemed to be rather nice. I mean, she was caring and all this other stuff. But there was your mother, okay, your mother.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and kids so want the love from the mother. Even at that age, kids can be forgiving. Plus, the fact they don't understand everything at that age. But you want so badly to grab her, to hold her, to have you, her love you, to accept you, and not to go away again because this is mommy. And you see, that's very, very sad. That's truly a very sad thing. But and when children are left at that age, I was left at that age. I understand where you're going from. The hole that's in your heart. Okay, is as big as a Grand Canyon, and your brother and you were actually displaying that fear, that hurt, and that emptiness. You know, mommy's going to go away again. You know, so this is truly a very sad story. And yet, I hate to say this, but there's so many of us out there that have similar stories. You know, and so we end up with similar, you know, problems. Go ahead. Go ahead from this point on from the courtroom. Go ahead.
Thank you. And you're absolutely right. There's way too many of us, I know. And and I agree that I think at that age, even though I had been through so much, it's not like I could sit with her and say, Mommy, this happened to me. You know, and someone hurt me. I mean, that conversation never happened with her. I never sat down and said, you know, because I wasn't even processing at all, you know. And even though she was troubled, and even though she was on the street and she didn't have it together, there was a very soft, loving safeness to her. And even now, as I listen to her voice, it's like that voice that I knew in her womb. It's that voice. It's the voice of my mother.
Yeah.
You know, that I can still remember then in that courtroom, you know. And so that was it. I mean, we walked away, and that was the last time I saw her for many, 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 many years. And she did in fact sign her rights over and convinced John, my biological father, to do the same. And and we went into, at that point, the system, the foster care system, or social services rather, they felt that we would be very hard to adopt because we were not babies. We were, you know, at that point, 5 and 6. We were traumatized, troubled. Neil might have been a baby. It's possible. They didn't know, but he certainly had signs of having just being dependent and just having some difficulties and delays. And so, just a lot was going on. And also the fact that we had to stay together. So being a sibling group, and it just made a lot of things very challenging. And so we were asked to go to an adoption picnic where they had us wear our names across our chest. And it was basically like the clearance rack of San Diego kids who, you know, here you go. You know, these are the ones that are a little harder to get adopted. So come on out and have a look. And so tons of prospective parents came out. And it was Neil that actually, they separated us. They didn't have us together. I was doing one thing on one side of the park, and Neil was doing something else. And he was this really, with a Cherokee Indian background, so we were very, like, it's just a very tan complexion, but very blonde toe head. And we just had an interesting look. And so they saw Neil, my parents did, right away, and they were looking for a little boy because they'd already adopted a little boy who was 3 at the time. So they were looking for a boy and only a boy. In fact, my mom did not want a daughter. She had a stepdaughter who was a real nightmare for her, and she just thought girls were very trouble, and they were difficult and dramatic and moody, and so she didn't want a girl. And so they found Neil. They loved him right away. And then our social worker said, well, he comes with a sister, you know. And and so that's how that came to be, you know. And we were adopted eventually into that home. And from there, my parents, I mean, the house that I was adopted into with my brother was, man, I mean, if you could put on paper the perfect little family, it was like, you know, my father was captain of the fire department, and my mom was would become the, you know, paint sweater soccer mom, you know. It just, she was that, and he was that, and our house was like white picket fence and a dog and a cat, and you know, it was just that. But there was a lot of stuff going on in their marriage. There was a lot of my mom had a lot of insecurity. She could never have her own children, and so when she adopted us, which was interesting because we were out of birth order. That was an interesting way to adopt as well. She adopted it. The first baby she adopted was a birth baby. So she got my brother Steve at 2 hours old, right out of the hospital. Neil and I came later, 3 years later, and we were 5 and 6. So that changed a lot of things in the household. But my mom, even though they knew to an extent, and they didn't know all of the abuse, because there was a lot of abuse that I remembered that nobody had asked me about in all those years, and it wasn't documented, and no one knew. But, of course, she did know about the boy. She did know. That she knew. But she did not want it talked about. And what was very difficult is that I was only required, my brother and I, to have 6 months of psychotherapy between the foster and adoption process. And so that's it. That's what they did. And after that, there was no therapy, no talking about it. It just wasn't discussed. It was like, that's the death of that life, and now you're born into this life. And that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And that was a whole other level of abuse that no one really talked
about. Okay, I hear the panel. I hear the panel making funny noises.
Please, go ahead.
Let me go to them. I'm not sure which one was making noises. Okay, Lisa, is there something you want to comment about or ask a question about?
Birds flying around my head right now. I'm going to pass and listen to the rest of the story. Let me pass now and go on to Deborah. And,
okay.
I'm hanging in, Jamie.
All right.
I'm hanging in.
I know these stories are always so hard, you know, and for some of us it's harder, and that's quite all right. Okay, let's go to Deborah from Arizona.
No, honestly, I'm listening to this whole story, and honestly, hearing you're saying that you couldn't be completely honest and that it was a lie for a little bit, and then you just took it in. That is a little bit crazy for me. But I understand it because I've done it for a long time. But I thank you very much for saying this, because as hard as it is for you to say this out loud, you're still saying it, and I so appreciate it. And I know everybody else on the panel does as well. We're just taking it in, and we want to give you the time for you to be able to speak about it.
No, she's doing a fine job. I heard the funny noises. I wasn't sure which one was making funny noises. Okay, let's go to Joe, because I thought maybe someone wanted to ask a question. Joe, is there something you'd like to ask or a comment you'd like to make? And then we'll get back to the story, because it's already 9:04. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I'd like to listen to more, too. I hope we can find out the resolution and about J.J., so... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to find all that out.
Carol?
Okay.
Carol?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I want to take my turn now. And first of all, good thing Charlie's not here. Jamie, Charlie's our in-house foster care expert, and I'm sure if he heard this story, he'd be climbing a wall
right
now.
He'd be
there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Anyway, I have a question. With regard to this home you're in now and with this mother that didn't want a girl, but when you get adopted like that, isn't there any follow-up? Like every 6 months they come and just make sure that, you know, the stuff that went on in all these other homes isn't going on now. Don't they check up on you periodically, or do they just adopt you and and close the file, and that's the end of everything?
That is a great question. I do remember my social worker coming by, I think, once or twice. But, you know, if you were to walk in the house, you would think, oh, I couldn't have put these kids in a better home. I mean, it was, I mean, my mother was like, you know, the Martha Stewart of our town. She was just dripping with sweetness and wonderfulness. And my father, the captain of the fire department, and everything just looked perfect. I mean, my room, I had in my own room, it looked like a flamingo threw up in there. There were so many toys and pink things and, you know, my mom went definitely had the look and love. I mean, she loved us so very much, but she was so, so misinformed on what would have been the right thing to do. And some of it, I feel like, should have been pretty easy to figure out. We absolutely should have been in psychotherapy throughout probably our whole childhood. Absolutely. And what bothers me greatly is, I recently was given a bunch of boxes. My parents sold our childhood home, and I was given a bunch of boxes. She thought it was just a lot of photos, and in it were receipts, all of the receipts of the money that they received every month for Neil and I, because we were adopted as special needs. And they received $498 per child per month in the 80s, you know, in early 90s. And I'm going, that money was not for us to have the pool put into the backyard and the Disneyland trips every year. That was supposed to be for Neil and I to have the support we needed. You know?
My question is, why were you pushed in as a special needs child? Where did that come in?
That came in because of the trauma, because they knew that we had been sexually and physically abused and that we were exhibiting behavior that was abnormal to an extent, that Neil was so delayed. He was so very delayed in a lot of ways. They thought he was in some ways having retardation or, you know, just very, you know, all of that. It ended up not, I mean, he graduated with a 4.0. He was a very intelligent kid, but he obviously was exhibiting, you know, PTSD, and later, much later, was it's clear that he's Asperger's. That's very clear now. But, you know, but as far as that goes, you know, I, on the other hand, was opposite. I was very overly mature for my age. I was worldly. I was, you know, I wasn't a child in any way. We didn't speak English very well, you know, and so there were a lot of these kinds of things, and so that's what they, that's how they adopted us, as special needs, So, very frustrating though to not have had that, and I can remember, you know, there would be times where new people would come into our life, and adults would ask me, you know, oh, you're adopted, Janie, I didn't know that. Tell me. And I would say more than was comfortable with my mom, and she would not be happy about it. I mean, I wasn't like physically punished, but certainly the shame storm was there, you know, like, no, that is our family. See, you don't talk about that, Janie, you know? And,
yeah, I get that.
You know, it's like, okay. And then, you know, you'd go to school and it was, let's do the family tree project. And then it was all these lies, you know, oh, you're named Janie after my cousin. And your family is Scottish and Irish and this and that. And it's like, that's not true though. I'd rather go in and get an F and say, I don't know what my history is, than to lie and pretend I'm someone I'm not and pretend I'm not who I am. And to feel like I had to kill JJ in order to be your perfect Janie, who has no problems, is a great kid, doesn't need therapy, you know, and so to bring this to the conclusion, everybody, I went years on in the straight and narrow. I never gave my parents any grief. I was really exceptional in every way, as much as I could be, and nobody's perfect, but I definitely never wanted to upset anybody. I'm very much a people pleaser. I wanted to be a good kid. My brother was the same. And 17 years old, I woke up one morning. I have to preface by saying that it was at this time that my parents were going through a very contentious divorce, and I was being made to be, I mean, there was a lot of parental alienation. There was a lot of just really abusive stuff going on emotionally. And it, I believe, was the straw that broke the camel's back, or just the, it was the tide that brought everything to the beach, everything. And I woke up one morning for school. I never had any health problems whatsoever, but I got out of bed and I passed out right at the side of my bed. I came to, I was confused about what happened. I took a few more steps into the bathroom and it happened again. And then it happened again. I was rushed to the hospital and they ran all kinds of tests. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. They sent me home. And to take a long story a little shorter, this continued on until the passing out became petite mal seizures, or what looked like petite mal seizures, what now might be something you might say is a disassociation. So I would be sitting at the kitchen table. I'd be in the middle of laughing at a joke or something, and I'd have fork moving up to my mouth, and I would freeze. I would totally dissociate. I would be gone. They thought it was petite mal seizures. And when they couldn't find the right medication or the right treatment for that, it progressed into grand mal seizures. I was having full-on convulsions, which now you might want to, you might say is more of hysteria, or what used to be referred to as hysteria. I would be in the middle of class. I'd be in my biology class, and I would have these convulsions so hard I'd have concussions from hitting my head on the ground. I was so out of it. I mean, it didn't matter if I was wearing a skirt and the whole school saw me flailing about and showing all my goodies. It didn't matter. I didn't even notice. I was so out of it, anything could happen. So I was removed from my senior year, and I was home hospital, which means I had a tutor come in to my house. I was confined to my house with my mother, which was interesting, and missed most of my senior year. No one could figure out what was going on with me. Finally, after a year and a half of this, I was admitted to UCSD Hospital in San Diego. They gave me 1 week, 7 days. They implanted electrodes into my cheeks and my scalp, and they had cameras all over the room, and they said, you're confined to this room for 7 days, and we're going to do everything we can to induce a seizure, and we're going to find out what's really going on. So they hyperventilated me. They did strobe lighting, everything they could think. Nothing was working. And on the seventh day, they brought in a psychotherapist, and she asked questions nobody had asked me. Nobody had let me talk about. And immediately I had a full-blown grand mal seizure. My whole body broke out in a rash. My eyes dilated. I lost continence, the whole thing. Everything looked like I had epilepsy, but in the moment the doctors were able to see, my brain waves were completely normal. So they walked into the room and said, great news, you're not epileptic. We do know that it's a non-epileptic seizure disorder. What that basically means is this is a psychological issue, not a neurological issue, and we want you to start counseling right away. And that was the beginning of that.
Yeah.
For sharing my story, getting it out. I was on anti-seizure and antidepressant medication for a couple of years. I had episodes here and there, but they became less and less and less. And I haven't had one in, 15 years probably now. So it is my story. I wrap it up by saying that I've learned we have to talk about these things. I held it in. I carried it with me. It's so cliche to say that, but I really did, in a way that it screamed out of me. It physically shook out of me. By the time I was 17, I couldn't hold it in anymore. And I very much resent that I had to kill JJ. I'm still trying to learn how to revive her or bring her back and just have that inner child within me know that she never died. She's not forgotten. Her story matters. Her pain mattered, and that's something I'm still working on. And I want every adopted parent to know that we can never and should never ask, as they say, who does this child belong to, but who belongs to this child? And I have a lot of people who belong to me. I have a story that belongs to me, and I don't want that story to be killed off anymore. So that's why I'm here telling it, and I appreciate so much all of you giving me the time to do it. And I'll take any questions and stop my chatter at this point. But that's my story, and thank you.
Okay. Well, let me just start off by saying, too, you had many grand mal seizures. I've seen over 100 of them. I know what grand mal seizures look like. Now, you haven't had one in 15 years. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that what you, okay. How many times have you told your story? How do you feel telling your story tonight?
I was on an adoption panel for several years in San Diego. I told this story to help adoptive parents who were about to adopt children to understand that it was okay to adopt special needs children or children with trauma backgrounds, that we're not all going to go to drugs and sex and destruction, that some of us can actually turn a good leaf and be good people, and that's what I did. So I've told the story more times than I can count, but it took a long time to be able to do that, or to have the permission to do that, I should say. Yeah.
Right, right. Permission, you say permission. Permission from whom? Your inner self or yourself, or where does that permission come from? Permission from places where you're going to speak?
From my parents that raised me.
Okay.
I think that codependency was there, that I didn't want to shame them. It felt like it shamed them for me to tell people my ugly, you know.
But it's not your ugly, it's your story. And you did a marvelous job tonight. I mean, fantastic job. Well, I want to get into right now about your hypnosis and so forth and you know, the solution. You speak a little bit about, of course, that people who adopt children, that they should have had, and I agree with this wholeheartedly. I mean, you kids needed all kinds of therapy for many, many years, you know, and you didn't get it, you know.
No.
So you went through all kinds of hell for years, because we know as survivors that if you don't tell your story, if your story doesn't come out, and of course, look at the way it came out with you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't come out, then we suffer from all kinds of, you know, terrible things in our lives. A lot of us turn to alcohol and drugs. You didn't, thank God, or turn to cutters, or we're people pleasers, or whatever the heck it might be. There's just a whole long list of what we become. When you were going to school in high school, I'll ask you this last question, because I want you to start talking about your hypnotherapy. But when you were going to school, all right, when you were actually going to school, did you have friends? Were you able to make friends? Were you social? Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a great question, Carol. I had friends. I had a very small, intimate group of friends. I always did. I've never, my whole life, have I ever felt like I was able to connect with my age group. I've always been way ahead. And so that made it difficult, because I didn't relate to a lot of the things that teenage girls related to. And and so my group was always very small. And that too felt a little shamey in my house, because my adoptive mother was like captain of her cheerleading team, and she really wanted us all to be super popular and out there, and I just never felt comfortable with that. So I kept saying small. I've always been very careful about I've always been very, I would say, selective and intentional about the people that I have around me, you know? And it's worked out well for me. I've come to enjoy
That's
part of myself, yeah.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean by that. I'm very selective, too, who I have as friends. Okay, so let's get into you, because it's getting late now. Yeah, it's getting real late. Today you are a clinical hypnotherapist, and you're specializing in trauma support and healing. Tell us about that, and what rate of people do you think that you're able to help with your hypnosis?
I haven't had anyone that's come to me that has felt like it didn't help to some degree. Everybody is different. Everybody has a different level of what they want to achieve. I'm not the hypnotherapist that you'll call for smoking cessation or to lose weight. There's thousands of people out there that would be happy to help with that. And I just don't, that's not where I want to use my energy and my work. So I work with trauma, anxiety, and sleep disorders. And everyone has some level of trauma. Everybody knows what trauma is. It might be on a scale of 1 to 20, but we all can understand what that means to some degree. And so I hold space for people to share because I understand that that's the number one issue a lot of us have, is that we don't get the space to be able to be authentic and share what it is and share it raw and so that's the number one place I go with people. And then I take them out of that conscious critical chatter that says, this is ugly. Nobody wants to hear this. I'm oversharing. This makes me different. I don't like it. I shut that down to a process. It's actually a very natural process. Everybody goes through it. We do it while we sleep. We do it in a lot of ways. I'm just trained through cadence and the way I use my voice to bring people to that state. And I basically send them, I create a space of comfort, of healing, of solidarity. And I reframe the way they think about it. It's not, I can't take it away. I don't ever regress people back into memory. That never happens. I never regress them and say, let's go to that scary, awful, horrible, painful moment. We don't do that. In fact, they don't teach it anymore.
Good.
It can be very dangerous to do that. But we don't do that. We work with the symptoms of it. And then ultimately people leave just feeling heard and feeling like I'm almost that maternal person that wasn't there in those painful moments, just to say, I see you, I hear you, it's okay. You know, like your story needs to be alive, even the painful parts of it. We can't kill it all. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We just have to be able to learn from it. That's the nutshell of what I do and why I do it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing. You see, we have all different ways, all different choices that any one of us can make, you know, for healing. I'm always happy when someone like yourself comes on, because my husband, I will give him this. He was a board certified, you know, hypnotherapist, and he was very good at what he did. Yes. Most of the time he dealt with smoking cessations, but sensate, whatever the heck it is. But
yeah,
to get rid of it, there you go. But he could do other things as well. He was very good at what he did. So he had people calling, you know, for quite some time, and then it kind of like faded away. So what you're dealing with, I'm really so happy to have you on the show, because I do believe that there is a lot of, you know, success with people, you know, who can be hypnotized. Not everyone can be hypnotized. I know of people that we go to his office and it didn't happen, okay? You know, but there are those people that do benefit greatly by it. I'm going to go to the panel one more time and see if they have anything they'd like to ask you about the solution and, you know, what you were just talking about. Lisa from New York, do you have something you'd like to ask or make a comment about?
Very quickly, I wish this show would go on for another 4 hours, because I have 1,000 questions, but I'm going to pick one very important question, if you can answer it quickly. And I'm going to thank you so much for being on the show. This was amazing. You're just amazing. And you're just so open and honest. And,
absolutely.
And man, you got a big mouth, and that's a beautiful thing. Right, right, guys? Where and how is Neil now? Is he okay? And, you know, how is he in your life?
Thank you for asking about him. He's well. He did very good for himself. He's in the Navy. It's a career for him. He's been in the Navy now, I mean, since he was 18, and he's a submarine. So he's on submarines all the time. He goes on about three months at a time, and he does it twice a year. So he's 10,000 leagues under the sea more often than I would wish him to be. But he loves it, and he excels. I believe he's never been formally diagnosed, but he's to a T. He's Asperger's in every way, which also helps him in his career field. He does phenomenally with, you know, just the math and science of it all and taking direction. And so he excels, and he's awarded all the time. So he's married, and he's a stepfather, and he lives over in the Florida-Georgia line, and I'm here in California. So we don't live very near each other anymore, but we've always been very close in our hearts. And, you know, yeah, we have a story that no one else can understand but he and I, really, you know. So thank you for asking. Yeah.
Great story. Great story. Yeah. Not a happy ending, not an ending, but thank you, Jamie. Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
I'd like to say one thing. What's that, though?
I didn't mean to interrupt there, Carol. I just wanted to say I'm happy to offer my email for any additional. I know Lisa said she has 1,000 other questions, and I'd be very happy to answer them in email for anyone. And I can leave that with you all at the end of the call.
Okay, that's great. I want to make one point here, though. You're certainly well together today. You've brought yourself well together. You're doing well, and none of us are going to be 100%, Janie. You know, this is just the way it is when we go through such horrible abuse as this. And but on the other hand, you are doing fine. You are doing fine, and I'm so proud of you for that. I really am. Let me go to Deborah here in Arizona. Maybe you have a comment because the show is almost up. Go ahead.
Jeannie, thank you so much for everything that you have offered. Everything that you have said is just wonderful. I would love to speak to you after the show about your hypnotherapy and about how you deal with that. I just been through a whole hell of a whole deal, and I just found out the names of my predators that actually gang raped me. I have names now, and I'm just kind of like, wow, how do you deal with that? And it's something that you have to deal with. And on top of everything else, it's okay. I'm here, but I'm really interested in what you're doing, and I think you're doing a great job, and I love the way you speak, and I think you are very well-maintained, and I really love that, so thank you so much, and I would love to speak to you after the show.
I'd be so open to that, and I hope that you'll reach out to me. I'd love that.
Well, I have been on her website, okay, before the show. So if you look her up, is there somehow another way that people can reach you?
That's great. Yes, I'd like to be able to just have my website available. That way my phone number is there, my email is there. And that's journeywithjanie.com, journeywithjanie, and Janie is J-A-Y-N for November. I for igloo. Mm-hmm. There's no E on the end. It's just J-A-Y-N-I, journeywithjanie.com.
Okay, there you go, right there. Okay. I've already got my 90-second lady in my ear. In other words, the show is over.
My turn. I need to tell her one thing. Okay, please?
Go ahead. Hurry up.
JJ is not dead. You did not kill JJ. She is still within you, and you can talk with her, okay? Just treat her like one of your patients, one of your hypnotherapy patients, and talk to her. She's still there. She's been buried, but she's not dead, okay?
Amen.
JJ's still there.
Thank you.
That's our inner child. That's what we're speaking about here is the inner child.
Yeah,
that's another subject in itself. Yes, she is.
Thank you so
okay,
much for that.
Listen, guys, I would love to carry this on all night long, I think, because there's so much to think about. But, you know, we can't do that. So just say goodnight, okay? And listen, please do come back anytime, all right? And be a panelist. We could certainly use your information and also your expertise on clinical hypnotherapists and so forth. So you have our telephone number. You just gave out your website, and people will be calling you, okay?
I would appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for everything, you guys. A big hugs to you all and for your own journeys of survival and just much love. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. I'm going to have to say good night. Everyone, God bless you. And tomorrow's another show, or not tomorrow, sorry. Come back on Sunday and we will have another show. Okay. Good night and God bless.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was